Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Welcome back to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. This is episode 34. And I'm here with Stephen. You need to say something, Stephen, so they know you exist.
Well, I'm sure after 33 episodes, they ought to know I exist.
Okay, right. It's not a figment of my imagination, boys and girls.
I think, therefore, I am.
Right.
Who was it said that? I can't remember, actually. Aristotle, was it? Anyway.
It's probably Winston Churchill. He says everything else.
No, way before his time.
But in the morning, I'll be sober. We had an interesting discussion last week about pregnancy, one which I have zero experience about, so it makes my job easier as a co-host, because I can ask about things and my ignorance is for real and I'm not pretending I'm ignorant, which I find very easy to do.
And no, you're not pretending not to be ignorant, Chris. That's a
difference. No, stop it. No, that's it. Sorry, ladies and gents. So we thought we'd as we said at the end of the last podcast, that we'd move this on a little bit. After, from birth, is the effect of relationships on couples of this new small human being that's entered their lives. But we want to keep it so that it's not just sort of the standard heterosexual couple, but other people who are also maybe adopting children as well, is which of course can happen at any age range, I guess. One of the reasons for adopting it might be is age and maturity. But the effect of on relationships, of all of a sudden there's two of you, Stephen, of you have been cruising along, been having a great time, you've had the relationships, the sharing, on holidays together, you've had the sex together, everything. Hang on, we woke up this morning and there's another little bundle of activity in the same house.
Okay, let me give you a little story here of how this might kick in. This happened with me on my second relationship. I was married and my second child had just been born, Jay. Now, I've been with my second wife for a number of years. We had a stable relationship, and that's why we did go into marriage and we did go into having a child. So Jay gets born, is at this Yorkshire hospital, little baby, and all healthy and well and great. And I remember it's Easter. I think it was Easter Monday or thereabouts, that when Joe was born in the March. And I'm in my car. I'm driving to the hospital because that morning Jay is going to come out of the hospital with my wife, and we're going to go home. First time as a couple, as a family actually. First time as a family, not as a couple. So the hospital actually going to let the baby go. And they've got to make sure that everything's okay. They come out and check the car. They make sure the car, everything's ready, and you've got everything.
Oh, they did that. The hospital staff did that.
Yeah,
that
they come out.
That's good.
Yeah, well, they did at this particular hospital. So the baby is if I remember rightly, the baby Jay is a little baby. We had to be in some sort of protected seating or cot or something in the car. So, because at that point the hospital letting go of the responsibility.
Yes.
Right. But my wife was very, very nervous, and I couldn't understand. I mean, I understood, but it was an extreme nervousness about this moment of the baby going in the car. She'd given birth. She had four days in the hospital. The baby was perfectly healthy. We were going into the car, but there was this moment where my wife had to sort of recognize there was a risk, because we're in a car now with a little baby, and who knows what's going to happen on the way from the hospital to to our home.
Yes.
And it was signaled to me, and it didn't happen with my first my first child was born, but it happened when Jay was born. It signaled to me the extreme anxiety and nervousness and risk and uncertainty that comes with this little baby coming in.
Yes.
And it was very, very heightened for my wife in a way that it wasn't for me. Now, you might say, well, as a father, you should have been equally nervous. Well, if I'd just been as nervous as my wife, I wouldn't have been able to drive the car. Someone had to drive the car. Someone had to get us home. Someone had to take responsibility for that and settle it down. But my wife was freaking out. And I just... obviously, we then get into a routine of JB and the baby in our house and the home, and we start to live as a family for the first time.
Having gone through that before, did you take a more proactive role in the relationship than you would have done had you been had it been your first, you know?
When my first child was born with Gavin, and that would have been, I don't know, nearly two decades earlier. Because I think Gavin was about 20 when Jay was born. In the 70s, early 70s, for one thing, you never went in the maternity ward. You were never as a
dad, you weren't allowed.
No, you weren't allowed.
I didn't know that. Really,
no, you weren't allowed. You paced. You know, it was the stereotypical pacing outside. In my case, I just had to sit in a waiting room somewhere
and sweat it out
and wait, and then you let in. I remember when my first wife, yeah, Rosemary, was. Having had Gavin, I was allowed in after all the experts and professionals had done their job. I've got my little baby Gavin there, and he's in Rosemary's arms, and it's all, the place has got to be sort of cleaned up before Dad can come in. I'm talking now about 1974, right. So I'm brought in by the midwife. The midwife lets me into this ward.
Don't tell me you had to put a gown and mask on.
No, I didn't put gown and mask on, but because there was blood all over the floor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was blood already all over the floor. I mean, my wife just given birth, and birth is a bloody mess. That's what it is. You can't give birth without the bleeding the blood. So there was blood on the floor, and it was still, there was all the aftermath of the birth, not the afterbirth itself, that had all been cleaned up, of course, but the baby was wiped down, but there was still blood on the baby's face, and the baby's face was still squashed after coming out the vagina, as babies are. They all look, old babies look like Winston Churchill as soon as they come out to get born. So I, as a young man, my first encounter of giving birth, that was it. Now go forward 20 years and I've got my second wife, Sally. And that was entirely different. I mean, Sally and I, we shared everything through the birth, and I was there throughout her getting born, when Jay was born. And I can remember vividly, because it was a Saturday afternoon, the 27th of March, 1993, and the Cambridge-Oxford boat race was on. and they had the television in the maternity room, and my wife wanted to watch have this noise or this boat race going on, all the paraphernalia leading up to it and afterwards, while she was giving birth.
I'm biting my tongue.
So I'm, you know, giving a massage and helping her while she's actually giving birth. So you're very involved, and you remain involved. And that's quite common nowadays, I have to say. That's generally the routine. And I was involved when both Robert and Anna were born, with Deborah. So... But yeah, you then go home, going back to the baby into the car. You got this little thing in the car. It's for me, it's my second son. For Sally, it's her first child. And a great degree of nervousness. We actually get home without an accident or without the baby having any problems. And then you're into the lifestyle of being the family.
Does the child make relationships stronger or threaten them? We touched on that in the last episode. There was one point I remember we said, you know, the child becomes a competitor for mum's affections for the dad. Does that happen?
Yeah, it does. Many fathers will recognise that once a baby comes along, then there is a competitor for their affections. And many men will feel vulnerable. They'll feel angry. They'll feel let down or isolated because they've had this presumably complete loving relationship with their partner, and then suddenly this third entity comes in.
The monopoly is gone.
And it can be very disrupting for some men, and the women often can't understand it, because all they're doing is what they feel is a natural response, which is to devote their love and attention to this little thing that needs them, and this little thing can't do anything without them. And most women are the primary carers. It's not the men who will do the breastfeeding. It's not the men who will clean up all the nappies and the shit and all the rest of it. It's what
Is that still true? Okay, forget the breastfeeding because the guy can't do that. But all the other bits that you just mentioned, and plus more, the sort of the support structure to allow this little human to grow. Isn't that stereotypical thing? Is that changing?
It depends which society we're looking at. Remember, we're talking here in Thailand in Chiang Mai, and obviously our conversation is predominantly about the Western phenomenon. If you move out to other parts of the world where gender relationships are structured around a more patriarchal system, then the women are going to be the ones caught up with doing all the childcare, all the work, all the caring. The men are not going to get involved hardly at all. But in the West, where there's now, after so many decades of equal opportunities, not just legislation, but equal opportunities thinking, a more feminist approach to it, a recognition that women and men should share in a relationship, then it's likely to be more balanced. But it's not always the case. And one of the issues that comes out of relationships is the gender roles, the way the gender roles change. Because in the past, and it's something I write about in the Relationship Manifesto book, in the past, relationships were structured around traditional gender roles, where the man went out to work, he was a male breadwinner, the woman stayed at home, she was a primary carer, she cooked the meals, she looked after the babies, she had the babies physically, the man provided the sperm, the woman provided the egg, but when that baby was born, the woman gets on and does all the traditional feminine bit, brings the baby up, possibly with the support of her mother, or other friends, female friends in the community. Yeah. The man's off to work in the factory, in the office, in the fields, whatever he's doing. And that system went on for a long time. It's not, we have to be careful here, assume that it's always been like that, because if we go back to very early times of human life, then that pattern was not necessarily the case, but it certainly emerged in the case.
Do you have an example of that?
I think that there's examples of before we had traditional societies built around agriculture and formal farming and the patterns of the season and communities were settled in fixed places, and we see the emergence of hamlets, villages, towns, and then cities. Before all that, there was more movement. I think there was more sharing. People who've done research in this area, the archaeologists and those scientists who explore early human existence, shows that there was apparently more sharing of roles. But that disappeared with the onset of advanced capitalism capitalism, when the certainly industrial revolution, when men went to work in the factories and women were staying at home and looking after the kids. Now I was born at the turn of that period, after the Second World War. That pattern of gender relationships started to change. We see the emergence of women coming into work. We see the emergence of men not getting work or spending more time at home, either because of unemployment or other factors. And the breakdown of the, we also see the breakdown of the traditional male breadwinner family, and the emergence of more fluid and flexible forms of family life, which are not just built around man, woman, and child or children. But that's all very well. But what hasn't correspondingly changed as quickly has been the emergence of breakdown of the traditional gender role, in so much as men taking on more responsibility in the family. So the consequence of that, and there's been a lot of research done on it, and those students of mine who are listening to this over the years I've taught over the years at Keele University, they will know I talked about the multiple roles, women's multiple roles, where women are caught up with now, and I'm talking about the West, not just the other parts of the world, but now in the West, women are caught up with, if they have children, they predominantly still the primary carers, but they're also often having to work because it's very difficult to hold a house together and all the costs of that, and raise a family with just on one income. So you've got both partners working.
So the emphasis on having to work rather than choosing to work.
I think it's a balance, isn't it? Some women will say, well, I want to work, I want to have that financial independence, but they also recognition if they're in a family with children, they have to work. They may want to work out of desire and career aspiration, but they have to work as well.
Yeah, I hear the phrase, I'm going to put my career on hold for ourselves.
Yeah, I have
mixed feelings about that phrase.
Yeah, well, it's different. Women will have different approaches to it. But the point is here that can these relationships survive the impact of a baby? Because that's what we're trying to look at in this podcast. And I think they can survive. But for me, it takes it requires a balance, because some women, if they're with a partner who doesn't want to play any role whatsoever, who doesn't want to get up in the middle of the night and do any feeding, who doesn't want to change a nappy, you know, gets upset at the eye, at the sight and smell of a dirty nappy. Right. Just all he wants to do.
Talking about me again, aren't you?
It's just that in that situation, that's all the onus goes on, and responsibility goes on the woman.
Yeah.
And that's not going to be conducive to a good relationship.
Yes.
You've suddenly got a relationship out of balance. And I've often had this conversation with students of mine when I've taught gender and identity and work. Certainly at Keele University, at undergraduate students, many women students who are not feminist when they're in the 20s, 21, early 20s, because they don't feel an association with feminist theory or feminist principles. For them, you know, they're at university, they're going off into the great wide world of work, the opportunities are open to them. The world's my oyster. I say to them, that's fine. But if you get into a relationship with a guy and you have children, then that's when a new reality can often kick in. And that new reality can be, well, suddenly, because you're a woman, you're doing everything. The guy's still following his lifestyle, his pattern, which is go off to work and earn his money. You're having to pick up the primary responsibility for the care of the child and still work.
Do you think most women do it, or do they fight it? Do they just fall into the mold because it's comfortable or easy? Or?
I don't know. There's no stats on this, but we know it's an insidious problem, because there's a lot of emotional pressure on women to follow to be the mother.
Yes.
The father, the social pressure on a male to be a father has heightened, I have to say, in the last few decades. Oh, sure. I mean, I'll give you the example of me. When my first child was born, I didn't have to attend at the birth.
Yes.
Two decades later, the expectation is I'll attend at the birth. It's not do I want to or not, but I expected to be there. And then there's the expectation that before the birth, you'll have attended all the parents' evenings.
And the Lamar's classes, is that what they call it? Yes.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. Yes. That you're part of that process of learning how to be a parent before you actually become one. And that's just implicit in that, is that you're taking responsibility for what comes next, which is this little baby that's coming into your life. So there's more pressure on men to be responsible fathers when they become fathers. But it's relatively new. The social pressure on women to be good mothers is awesome. Women look at each other and judge each other in a number of different ways, and it's a female gaze on female that's most powerful. Women,
peer pressure, yeah.
Peer pressure, female peer pressure on you. What's your baby like? If you go into a, I'll give you an example. You go in the supermarket and a baby's crying, right? And you know that babies do cry, and little toddlers can be awkward and go into tantrums. If it's a man with that baby on his own, or with a little toddler, the chances are one of the supermarket staff, likely a woman, will come up and try and lend a hand. Another mother will come up and say, "Are you okay? Do you want a hand here?" Right? Because I'm talking now about a man on his own with a pram,
yes,
or with a little toddler that's doing the tantrums. And believe me, any parent out there who's had this, you know it's an awful experience, and I've had it many times. You go into the, I'm talking about a supermarket. Supermarket staff will come up and say, "Do you want a hand? Can I help you?"
Yes.
Right? Another mother passing by, a woman passing by, will come, "Do you need a hand?"
Yes.
Now, if that's a mother on her own, she's expected to get on a cope. No one's going to come and help her. A woman on her own with a pram, with a toddler, the other women will look at her and say, "Why aren't you dealing with that? What's happening?" It's very, very different.
You think this is still the case? This is practice at this very moment in time, do you think?
The gaze on women to be good mothers, and I use that in inverted commas, is very, very powerful, and that's not gone away at the beginning of the 21st century. There's a more pressure now on fathers to be good fathers and to be responsible and take responsibility, but many fathers fail to do that, either supporting their partners financially or supporting their partners emotionally. But it is changing for the better, and there's more equality. At the same time, there's many women who will say, well, we talked in the early podcast about women who decide that they want to have children, but they don't want to have a husband to go along with it. And what do women said to me? they say, well, I don't want two children. I have a child. Why do I want a husband? I've got to have another kid.
Yes.
I've got to look after him and I've got to look after the baby. They're better off on their own, particularly if the woman or the mother-to-be has got her own network of support.
Family. Family and work.
So my advice to any couple, and they'll know this anyway. Obviously, you get your support network up and operative as soon as you can, because you're going to need it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question which is slightly related to that? Do you think being is the right term house husband? Do you think there's stigma to being a house husband?
Not anymore.
Is that the right term? Is that
that's the right term? Yeah. There was. I mean, the number of house husbands in the UK is increasing. I think probably about 10 or 15 years ago, it was about 60,000. We're now looking at maybe 400,000. Now, I have to say
You're talking about the UK?
I'm talking about the UK. And who are the house husbands? Well, predominantly, they tend to be middle-class professionals who can take time out of their career, who are married also or in relationships with female middle-class professionals who also have got good income. So you've got a situation where you've got two professionals, one of whom is earning enough money for the man to opt out and be the house husband. I've had friends who are house husbands based in the UK, and they enjoyed it. They loved it. They stopped being the lawyer or the architect or whatever, and they just devoted themselves to raising children, and not just one, but maybe two or three. And the wife, she went off, she produced the children physically, but then she went off and followed the career. It can work. Why not? It depends on how you negotiate.
I have a feeling you'd have to be a very mature guy to become a house husband. Because often the job is your stature or maybe status.
It's more than status. Jobs for men is about identity. Work is related to identity. What you do is who you are.
So you're dropping that. Sounds like a very brave thing to do.
It is a brave thing to do. It's not
the easy route, is it?
No, not necessarily at all. It's existentially quite threatening, because suddenly you are in the position that the women have been in over time, which is that you're now relying on your female partner to bring the money in. And you know it's like in today's world of work. If you come out of work for a period of time, you lose that momentum, you lose the edge. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be easy for a man who's a house husband to put that on his CV and 10 years later and say, well, I want to come back into my profession now where I left off, and I've spent 10 years as a house husband, and that's taught me a lot of skills about patience and caring. And the future prospective employer is not going to look at that and consider that you're any more valuable than you were before. And that's the problem that women have, because women take time out from work. It's a brave woman who will put on a CV. If she's had a professional career, she takes 10 years out in order to raise a family. She then puts on a CV, I've been a housewife and a mother, and expects the future employer to be enlightened enough to recognize that that's taken a lot of courage and skills and whatever, and will judge her on that basis.
Mm.
Because meanwhile, the 10 years that the person's been out as a mother or father, doing the house husband, the housewife,
they may have become de-skilled.
They've become de-skilled, yeah. And today's world is moving on so rapidly.
And a 50-year-old costs more to employ than a 20-year-old.
Yeah, it's all these issues, and I think it comes back to how you having babies. I mean, I think we've got, as I said last week, we've got 7 billion. Of us now in the world. We don't need many more kids. The populations in some countries are drastically problematic. Russia and Japan are two. Other countries, which are desperately poor, have got more mouths than they can possibly ever feed.
Yes.
So the wealthier countries are having fewer kids because the women are making the decision to follow a career.
Yes.
And if they are having children, having one, and they're devoting themselves to that one child, which is where you get the concept of the tiger mum, where the mother's got one child and she's not going to let anything get in the way of that child's progress.
Yes.
Through schooling, through university, through life. It's so the tiger mum phenomenon in the UK or in the West, and out especially out here in East.
Sorry, define the tiger woman again.
Tiger woman, the tiger mother.
Tiger mother.
Tiger mother is a tiger mother is someone who is absolutely fixated on the progress, intellectual, educational, emotional, physical progress of her child. She's usually got one child, though not necessarily always the case, but usually one child. She's probably educated, well, most certainly educated, professional woman herself, And that's her one child. She's invested all her future, yes, existential future, in that one child.
Yes.
And she can be a real pain for the teachers and headmasters of schools who've got to deal with them. Because if you're headmaster of a school and you've got 400 tiger mothers, then you've got a problem. But that's a phenomenon, and it's coming about because, you know, professional women having fewer kids, and when they have one, they devote all their attention to that one child's well-being.
Yes.
If you've got seven or eight kids, you can't afford to devote all your attention to one. You've got to spread it across seven or eight.
I should imagine just sheer survival skills of... I have so much admiration. How you can manage a family of,
well, yeah,
even half a dozen kids, you know, it's...
But our expectations are different nowadays, because we're expecting to have the house and the holidays and the good life and all the rest of it.
The iPads, I know, it's increasing, and the iPhones, and the...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you provide it for one. Now, if you were in a relationship where you've, whatever it is, where it's gay or straight, and you're not having children, then these issues don't arise. But if suddenly you're in a relationship where a little baby comes along, then you've got to make these adaptations. You've got to negotiate a new relationship almost with your partner. And then it encapsulates everything. It encapsulates, particularly got to encapsulate the sharing of roles.
Mm.
Who does what? Mm. When? Mm. Who's going to get up at tonight? You're both tired. You might have both been working.
Yes.
Who's going to be the one that's going to get up and feed a little baby at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're in deep sleep?
Yes.
And I've done it, and it's bloody awful. No one volunteers to do it, but you've got to do it.
Yeah.
And you can't just lay it on your partner. Then there's the issue of all aspects of parenting that start to kick in as the baby gets older. But even those first few months, when the baby's first in the house, you're into an entirely different lifestyle. You've got this little thing in your life that's in your house and in your life that you love immensely.
So the babies bring... I think I asked the question before. Do babies bring couples closer together further apart?
Not always. You know, often it can be just the opposite. They can split couples up. I think it's a wrong... I would counsel any couple against assuming if they've got a problem in the relationship now, and they haven't got kids, that problem's going to be resolved by having a child.
Because you hear that, don't you? Yeah, or stay together for the kids.
That's a different one. That's a different one,
okay.
Chris. The staying together for the kids, and there's hoping that you've got, because you've got a problem in the relationship now and you haven't got kids, and that you then have a child for the first time, that bonding is going to bring you together. That's a big risk.
It's not going to happen.
Well, it can happen, but it's a big risk, because I think that having the baby, this little thing in the house, in the room, is not... That's a disruption. That's effort. It's work. It's physical labor. This is not just about little harmony where this little baby's being sung to sleep at 7 o'clock at night and then goes to sleep and wakes up when you wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning.
We're back at the Disney model.
That's Disneyland. Forget it.
Yeah.
This baby's going to cause you mayhem.
Yes.
And it's not going to stop causing you mayhem until well, it may never stop causing you mayhem in some cases. But for me, I like being with teenagers. My parenting skills have kick in better when the child gets about 13 and onwards. Up to those early years, I've always found it very hard work.
But then it does what you said earlier, is your son becomes your friend, not your son.
Well, that's a different podcast when we're moving into that area. But if we're talking about the baby, has no
support... Everything has to be done for
everything
the baby.
Has to be done. The baby can do nothing. It's going to lie there and die if you don't do something.
Yes.
It's going to cry itself to death.
Yes.
That's what babies will do.
Yes.
It's not going to move. You've got to do everything. And it's suddenly going in a couple where you've just concentrated on yourself, and your biggest worry is, well, am I going to buy a Porsche next year? Or am I going to buy a Mercedes? Okay, I exaggerate, but you know what I mean.
Yes,
you're focused on the material.
I do.
You go from that to wondering, well, God, I can't even, I don't know if I'm going to survive next week. I'm so tired, I want to just cry.
I want to sit down in front of the telly when I get home from work, order a pizza and open a can of beer and relax for the evening. Those days have gone.
Those days have gone. Because you now, what you've done, and this is what I did in situations, you now got this little speaker in the lounge.
Oh, the baby something, isn't it?
Yeah, because your baby's upstairs in the cot upstairs in the bedroom, and you've got a little speaker tannoy in the lounge, and you're watching your favourite programme on television, and you've got a couple of beers inside you, and then suddenly the noise kicks off. you know, and then you've got to go upstairs, you deal with it. But you can't go anywhere. You can't go at night without getting a babysitter.
Yes.
Getting a babysitter is a logistical nightmare. That's only if you've got one child, unless you've got parents to hand.
Yes.
There's the cost of it. You've got to get car seats, and the car seats have got to change as the baby gets bigger. You've got to decorate a room. You've got to take, going on holiday, going on a plane. You know, you do a lot of flying, I do a lot of flying. What do you want to avoid most of all when you go on a plane? Babies. Yeah. You know, and I experienced flyers, and you know where not to sit on a plane. Yes. Because you know where the planes are going to put the kids.
Yes.
And you don't sit by those big head areas.
That's right, where the baby costumes go to the wall.
Stay at the back.
Or no bulkheads for me, please.
You don't go near the bulkheads.
Yeah.
Because that's going to be mayhem. And if you're on a long-haul flight from the UK to Bangkok,
yes.
And you've got kids screaming,
yeah.
What a nightmare that is. So you don't want to be part of that. But if you're the parent, you've got no choice. You've got to be part of that.
Yeah.
I watched the situation even this week. I was flying from Bangkok to Chiang Mai, just a 1-hour flight. And the flight was ready to go. We were all sat in the plane, and we suddenly got this delay. And the delay was for this woman who got late. And the sort of this sigh of relief came up from the passengers, you know, so finally we can get off. And then who comes on the plane but this Harris woman with two little toddlers. One she's carrying couldn't have been more than 6 months old, and one's, you know, probably about two and walking beside her, and she's coming on with these two kids in a bag, and she's got to get to a seat, put them in the seat. You know, and I felt so sorry for her, and she did it very well. And this woman, I think she was actually, I don't think she was Thai, I think she may have been Chinese. She was on her own.
Yes.
And all the logistics of taking kids anywhere, all that. So this is the reality you've got.
I have a lot of admiration for that process, simply because I've never been through it.
The other thing I want to talk about is first of all, keep the. I know you're going to warn me on time on this one. So you've got to try and keep the relationship together. But what I want to say is that if you've not. If you're planning on children, then you are very much into this unknown area. You don't know what's going to happen next. Obviously, keeping a good sex life will be key. Once you've got over the physical...
Key? It sounds impossible.
Well, you've got... No, it's not impossible. You can do it. And it's... Now, that's why you get second children coming along and all the rest of it. But it isn't easy. And you've... You know, the one thing I would warn some fathers for, if you're uneasy with the sight of blood... And you've got some mythical idea about sex, and so it's in a little box which has got, you know, around it some particular ideas. Then you don't want to see a baby coming out of your partner's vagina.
Not a good idea to video it.
Not a good idea to video. And I know some fathers who've done
they
it.
They do, don't they?
Yeah.
And
I think it's absolutely appalling. But they've done it. You've got if you sat there in a ward as I've done on two occasions with two different women. Looking at three kids and they're coming out the vagina, you then going to go back a few months or weeks later or whatever, and you're going to make love to that woman. That vagina's become a different place now. It's not this little mysterious place that you go to that you thought about, fantasize about when you were 15, 16, 17 as a boy, and you're masturbating five or six times a day thinking about this little pussy. It's now become this orifice that's produced this blooded, screaming little entity. That's a very, very different place to go. And you know, women have babies, they will shit. You know, they will excrete.
Right.
Shit, and it's messy. All the bodily functions that you can imagine.
So this brings us to the end of this podcast.
No, stay with me. All the bodily functions that you can imagine happen when during birth. Crying, screaming. The woman will... There will be. I guarantee any guy out there who's attended the birth of his child, there'll be one point when the woman, his partner, will turn and say, I hate you to hell. I don't want to ever see you again.
Because of
because
what
she's in so
through.
Much pain. Yeah, yes. She said, I don't... I mean, you know, she's in pain, she's distraught, she's lost it completely. And this can go on, a birth can go on for hours.
Mm.
You know, some women, after they've had a few kids, then sure, they can give birth pretty quick. But your first time, it's not going to be quick. It's going to go on a long time. And if you're there and you're involved in it, expect the trauma. Expect it's going to throw you. Of course, the upside to this is that after days after the birth, of course, the most women have forgotten it anyway. It goes out of the head. There's some sort of biological system kicks in that they then lose. They forget. And that's why they then often women will say, I want to have more kids. And they forget the trauma of the actual birth.
Yes.
That psychological process is fascinating in its own right, but it's not one I've I'm an expert in deciphering, but I have experienced it personally. So you're into this new world, and that this new world of the baby coming in, it begins with this little blooded mess, and you've got to decide whether, as a father, men do not feel under pressure to attend the birth if you're not up for that, because it's not for everybody. And coming back to the sex, you do want to rekindle that sexual mystery, that sexual energy.
So how do you do that?
Well, it works better if you're sharing. If your partner's angry with you or disappointed with you because you're not taking your share of the workload, that's a problem. Share your responsibilities, share the workload, give your partner time to rest and relax, and make your partner feel comfortable enough so you can get babysitter in, so both of you can go out and have a meal now and again, get some space on your own.
It's expensive to do that, though, and also find somebody you trust. That the economics means you can't.
It's not
you may
easy.
Not be able to do that.
It's not easy. And you compare that, all that paraphernalia of uncertainty and change and identity change. Both you and your wife are changing as well. You know, she's the mother suddenly, maybe the first time. You're the father for the first time. All this stuff kicks in. You compare that with this original romantic spark that happened some years back when you both met and you were both almost virginal by comparison, and there's that sexual desire and you could have sex all night and nobody's going to bother you, and you have a glass of wine and romance, or you can go and fuck in the car and, you know, on Bodmin Moor if you want. That's gone. There's a new world now, and this is the baby, and the baby defines it, and it will define your world.
So,
forever.
So
it's never going to go away.
Can mothers be romantic?
It's not very it's not.
Can dads be romantic?
Yeah, it takes time, you know. Because if you're sitting there, and let me give you an example. You're sitting in the lounge. You're both. Your wife's been at home all day, maybe with the baby. I'm talking about a young baby now. You've come home from work, you're both tired, you both want a glass of wine. The baby's quiet asleep upstairs, right? And then what does your wife have to do? Well, she has to get out this device which expresses milk. And it's a sucker that she attacks to her breast, and it will force milk out of her breast into this little jar. And that's what you're going to feed the baby later that night. Now, that's not the best prelude for a romantic, mysterious sexual encounter.
What's
2 hours later?
What's our foreplay tonight, dear? Well, hang on a minute. Just pops over the. It probably has a special name, doesn't it? A suction pump of some sort.
Isn't it a milk expresser?
Yeah.
But
so,
now there's another side to it, which is more sad and more serious, and that is it's something that's happened in my family, not with me or not with one of my partners, but it did happen with someone very close to me, and that's postnatal depression. Now, it's not a myth that women get the blues after pregnancy, after birth. They do, and women can experience this in different ways. It's a hormonal shift, where the body's getting back into balance.
Yes,
but it can last a week, it can last a few days, it might even last a month. But for some women, a small minority, there's something more serious, which is called postnatal depression. And postnatal depression is a very serious psychological problem, and with some women, it can be vivid evident in the first child, but it can kick in very severely in the second child. And someone very close to me ended up in a mental hospital to postnatal depression, and she was subjected to electric shock treatment in order to clear it, which was awful. And she was at one point put in a ward with very severely mentally disabled individuals. And this was all a result of after having her second child, where there was a warning on the first child, but it wasn't really picked up. The second child, postnatal depression kicked in. She had to go on heavy, very heavy medication, and still is to some point. And that is many years down the line after all this was finished. So postnatal depression is one thing. And again, that's something that you've got to look out for. I mean, that That couple, actually, I will say, that couple that I'm talking about now, who I know very well, were they got married, and this goes against the relationship manifesto hypothesis in some ways, or assumptions, but that couple got married when he was 19, she was 18. They both got married before they were 20. We're talking in the 60s now, 1960s area, late 1960s. They're now both in their 50s. They stay together all these years, never split up. They've raised two children. The woman's went through, as I said, a very severe postnatal depression, which lasted for on and off for probably 8 or 9 years severely. After the second child. And she was, this person was supported through that by her mother, who came in and helped and did all the necessary work and caring that was needed. So, because my friend wasn't physically there. She couldn't do it. When she was there, she was mentally out of it.
Yes.
She was like zombie-like.
Yes.
But they stayed together. That couple stayed together. They brought up two children. They're now adults and functioning, successful adults in their own right. And that the baby who was the trigger for the postnatal depression went on to become a mother herself.
Yes.
And they stay together, and they've lived that nuclear family life, and that's worked for them.
Yeah.
So, but they are that's the minority.
Atypical.
Very much.
Yeah.
They're not typical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did say at the beginning that we wouldn't stay with the heterosexual marriages. We'd look at two guys or two women together who have children by adoption.
Yeah. This is becoming more common now. I've got friends, I say, around the world who've done this. A couple I know in the States who adopted a baby girl from a Texas adoption agency of all times. Now, it's a gay couple. One of the men is African American, the other one is Latin American. So multicultural, mixed race, gay couple, and they have this legally adopted a baby from adoption agency in Texas, which Texas isn't the most seen as the most liberal of states in America. But yeah, the adoption agency was very enlightened, and this couple have got this little girl and they're devoted.
There's a lot of screening, I think, goes on before a gay couple is allowed to adopt. I guess the same as a heterosexual.
No
couple.
Different. They're the sexual yeah. couple. The adoption agency is looking the same thing. They're looking for commitment. They're looking for stability. They're looking for love, and they're looking for the ability to bring the child up in a secure environment.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I think the nobody screens a straight couple before they're allowed to have a baby.
Oh, I thought they did. You know, sort of.
I'm talking about before the.
Oh, sorry. I thought not know, before they adopt a baby. Before they have a baby.
Before they. So nobody
biologically,
says to.
Biologically.
Yeah,
yes.
That's right. Nobody says to a couple, a boy or girl or man or woman.
You're
going to have to go and come to the government agency. We're going to check you out before you have you're allowed to conceive.
Not with a Labour government anyway.
you just go away and you do it. But of course, adoption, because there's a being, an identity that's already present in the world, and that being and identity got a responsibility, and the government or agency got a responsibility for it, for protection, all the rest of it. Clearly, they're going to ensure that all the parameters are covered as best you can. So in many ways, the child that's going to be adopted is often in a much stronger position than a child that can be born into some, you know, almost ad hoc relationship, where the guy's not going to be around, where the mother's incapable or unwilling of bringing up a child. So I think if I was coming back into a next life,
you'd be quite happy to be adopted.
I would rather be adopted by that gay couple.
That was going to be my question. Actually.
Yeah, I'd rather be adopted by that gay couple, whether it be or a lesbian couple, who've gone through some sort of, have gone carefully thought about it.
Yes.
And you know, who are educated and capable and materially sound enough to bring up a child. That would be wonderful, because I'm going to go into an enlightened family setting. I'm going to go, because they're gay or lesbian, clearly I'm not going to get lumbered with all the gender stuff that comes with, often with heterosexual relationships. You know, I'm going to have the potential to live my life in a much more growing, a much more freer and enlightened environment. So I would say to all these little kids out there to forget the heterosexual couples, get with the gay couples, because they're the best ones to be brought up with, really. And would you rather be adopted with a gay couple, a lesbian couple, than take your chances with some heterosexual couple? Absolutely no. What would you
rather? They have not planned for you anyway.
Yeah, if you're there and you've had
this is depressing.
It's the moment of the gods say to you, well, like, it's your time. You're going to have to go back to work to Earth, and you're going to have another life.
But you have a choice.
You've got a choice. You can either take your chances with some heterosexual couple, or we're going to put you with a gay couple in America, black, white, Latino, whatever. Always take the gay couple, because the heterosexual couple, you might end up in some, poor situation in the middle, depressing slum in Sao Paulo or Mexico or the Sub-Sahara. Then, no way.
Is the adoption of children by gay couples a Western phenomenon?
I think, increasingly. I mean, it's certainly not prevalent of everywhere around the world. I mean, you've got terrible incidents of prejudice against homosexuals, particularly around the world. In certain parts of the world, it's highly dangerous to come out as a gay man, never mind getting married or having adopting. So parts of the West are far, far more enlightened, far, far ahead. The parts of America you look at, that's where they're pushing back the boundaries, even though there is resistance against it. I mean, you've got, to give you an example of what sort of resistance you've got people out in America, and America seems to be able to periodically produce these crazies who suggest that you can pray yourself out of being gay, you can pray yourself out of being
we
lesbian.
Touched on this earlier,
you can pray yourself out of having HIV, pray to God. I'm talking about the religious fundamentalists. And if praying's not going to do it, then we'll put you through a doctor, and the doctor will counsel you out of all this stuff. So the America's got that.
By America, you're talking about USA, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm talking about USA more than Canada. But it's there, and there's elements of that also in the in Europe and the UK. At the same time, you've also got many more liberal practices coming into play, and much more liberal attitudes being promoted and followed. Yeah,
I don't see many Asian gay couples with adopted children.
I don't know what the situation is in Thailand, but I think it would be very unlikely. I think Thailand's too conservative for that. Although Thailand is tolerant of LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual individuals, it's not altogether totally accepting. And there are. It's a very deeply conservative country, which is underpinned by its particular Buddhist philosophy and a bit of an unease about some of these changes in gender and sexual identities and roles that they see coming in from the West, that try to see coming to the West. You and I know Thailand's a place of paradox and contradiction. You come here and you'll see all expressions of sexuality and sexual identity, but you'll have this deep conservatism. So no, you won't get the adoption. But coming back to the babies, I think for men, it's becoming a father for the first time is a wonderful experience. I mean, it's not a journey that I planned or predicted. I've now got five children, four of them biologically, but I didn't see that when I was 21. I didn't think for one minute that would happen. I thought maybe I'd have a couple of kids and I'd live a traditional nuclear family life with my wife and house on the hill, and the kid is it's not happened like that. But the kids, we were talking earlier, the children are they can be a big demand. They can be a big demand emotionally, and they can be a big demand financially. And they've been a big demand on me financially, because I had three when I was in my 40s.
Yes.
Now there's still there's two of them have still not, or three of them still not at the university.
Still supporting
them. So I'm pretty much semi-retired So that's an issue. But what's it mean to me? Well, it's meant that I've seen an aspect of life that I wouldn't have otherwise seen, and I've got these young people as friends. And they are, you know, that I've, it's a wonderful experience to have that.
Yes.
In my life, because I know whatever happens in my life, I've got those children.
Yeah.
And that's a big comfort.
I've moved as a result of the last sort of 50 minutes, and we should bring it to a close soon. I think I carry this Disney-ish model in my head. It's the bouncing bundle of energy comes along and cements a relationship. Now I'm beginning to wonder how the relationships actually survive.
Well,
you know,
that's the question.
How on earth do you, do you survive all this?
Often they don't. You know, the people split up after children come along. There's no guarantee that children are going to make a relationship. In fact, there's more chance they will break a relationship. So be prepared for it.
Mm.
That's why I say you read the book, Relationship Manifesto, get the vows, clear the vows, and that's the good basis. Wherever your relationship's going to go in the future, if you've read the Relationship Manifesto vows and you can both of you honestly and sincerely follow those vows and speak them, that then even having children coming along, that will be sufficient foundation to cope with the disruption that a child will bring.
Yes.
Because eventually you will move beyond the disruption and it will become what it should be. Well, it is from the beginning a joyous, loving experience.
Family. Yes.
It won't be easy, but then why should it be? But if you're doing it together as a couple, married or not, then you've got something very special.
Yes.
And you'll always have, as long as the children are there in your life, you'll always have them. Even if you split up from your partner, or your partner splits up from you, as long as you keep in touch with the children, they're always going to be part of your life. They're never going to go away. And children need that contact. They need that to know that they're loved.
Yeah, I wonder if that might be a good place to stop. Actually, that was quite a nice positive comment to stop on. Might also be give us a lead into what we cover next week.
Mm.
Couples breaking up and what happens with the children. I can remember back, actually, 30-odd episodes ago, you touched on this about, don't stay together because the children, because the children are pretty switched on. But don't answer that now. I think that this might well be one, because we've done our 50 minutes. We have this time expansion from 30 minutes to 50 minutes. I'm going to call it a one-hour podcast anyway, and we always finish early. So we'll stop there, because that was a nice positive thing to stop on, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, Chris.
Remember, our blog is at relationshipmanifesto.posterous.com. You can leave comments, feedback, see the archives. And I think nothing else to add. I haven't missed anything, have I?
No.
Forgotten anything there? No. So, ladies and gents, boys and girls, see you again next week.
Thank you.
Have fun.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.